This is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations, the Iowa Arts Showcase. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom.
Now is the month of May when merry lads are playing.
Welcome to our May edition of the Iowa Arts Showcase. We catch up with two world-class pianists who created the inaugural Midwest International Piano Competition right in our own backyard. We learn about an architectural gem that shines quietly beside the Wapsipinicon River. We hear about the Des Moines Mentor Opera's amazing 42nd Summer Festival season and all their extra activities. And we welcome Iowa Public Radio's Executive Director, Myrna Johnson, back to the state. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Well, this is really Dimitri's brainchild. If I remember correctly, I think in your job interview, you had even mentioned that was a dream of yours to do someday. Or it was around that time, I think, when you first came
right here. It was right then when I actually had my job interview here in 2009. And the director, when I was talking to him, actually said it's really a great idea because we have this phenomenal facility. You know, the PAC and we have the Russell Building. You know, it's a shame not to have an event like this that would attract so much attention to our school. But after that, you know, we kind of were not too fast with it, and maybe for a good reason, because we know that in the last, you know, it's 2-3 years ago, we went through, you know, some severe budget cuts and all of that. So this actually is kind of a really a great time to have it. And it finally, we were able to sit down with Sean, his wife Serena, and my wife Paulina, and figure out some of the rules, repertoire requirements, and get this off to a very good start, I think.
And both of you, who are professional pianists, have had quite a bit of experience in the competition realm. Give us just a little bit of background about your careers and some of the competitions you've competed in.
Well, Dimitri and I actually first met at piano competitions. I don't remember when was the first time we met, but we competed against each other in Cleveland, and we were both in the finals of the Busoni competition. I think that might have been one of the first competitions where we became friends, and Dimitri did better than I did. I forgot, you got second, third prize.
There was no first, and then
right, and we were both in the final three, but I got bumped to fourth prize, but we won't talk about that. So, but yeah, this is like a competition circuit. I mean, we were always looking forward to seeing each other at competitions, and great thing is, you know, you learn a lot of repertoire, brings out the best, and you know, whether you win or not, that you get a lot of experience and make a lot of connections. So we're really excited to host this, and I think the great thing is, you know, we're really in the heart of the country, and there isn't any major competition that's representing the Midwest. There's a competition in Sioux Falls, a smaller one in Chicago and Wisconsin, but there's nothing that's really puts the Midwest on the map. And so I think the name of our competition, Midwest International Piano Competition, is perfect. It's great for marketing. It's going to put our name out there, and I think we're going to represent this part of the country really well. So we're excited for what's to come after our inaugural competition.
UNI's Associate Professor of Piano, Sean Botkin, and UNI's Assistant Professor of Piano, Dr. Dmitry Vorobiev. Both of these outstanding musicians in their own right have finally made their Midwest International Piano Competition a reality. A whole host of pianists from across the globe will be heading to Iowa to compete in this international competition, scheduled for June 1st through the 7th at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center under the auspices of the UNI School of Music. After some arm twisting, Dimitri and Sean were able to wrangle three internationally renowned performers and teachers into judging their competition. Both Sean and Dimitri feel the merits of hosting as well as participating in a piano competition can net far-reaching rewards.
You know, it's great for the area. It's great for our school, for the whole university. But also, we shouldn't forget that aside from it being great for the audience, for this particular town, it's also great for the musicians, for the pianists who compete. Because part of the reason why Sean and I competed in these competitions, it was a great way to play for an audience, for the jury, to really know where you stand as a pianist. And, you know, especially nowadays, it's really hard to get concerts for pianists who are really great. And competitions is just one of those tools that exists for people to present themselves, to get noticed, to perform in front of the audience that actually really cares. And yes, I mean, some people don't like competitions. They think that you should not bring sport into music. But, you know, I think it's really how you think of it. If you think of it, it's all about competition, it's all about being better, and maybe it's not too healthy. But I think if you think of it as just, it's a joy of bringing the music to people, to the audience, and showcasing what you can do on the piano. And there will be people who will like you a lot. There will be people who will love you. There will be people who will not like you at all. You know, and you have to be ready for it. But, you know, so many historical cases where, you know, Ivo Pogorelich, for example's career started from losing a competition when Argerich just stormed and said that he should have won, and that's what propelled his. And so many people hated him, but yet that's what made him famous. And so we won't go too much into history, but it should be a really great event.
Well, and including this, you also have this who's who of a jury. Tell us about the three judges you have that will be participating in your competition.
Well, I was able to invite my former teacher, Alexander Taradze, to be on the jury. He actually really despises judging competitions. I mean, he's said no to many requests to judge competitions like the Tchaikovsky competition and other big names. But his reason is just mainly because, you know, you always hear about some political things that happen. I mean, there's been stories of bribery, and he just doesn't like to deal with all that. But the fact that I used to be a student was the main thing. And he said, for me, he will do what he hates the most. So it's a thrill to have him here. And he has a huge career. And I think that's really exciting for the competitors out there, because, you know, I'm sure they all know that he doesn't judge, really. And so we're excited to have him. And Dimitri brought one of your former teachers.
One of my former teachers, Arthur Green, who came and played a wonderful recital here last year. So he will be one of the jury members. He is a professor of piano at the University of Michigan. And another person who is judging is the director of the Smetana International Piano Competition in Pilsen, Czech Republic, as well as the director of the Pilsen Conservatory of Music. And his name is Miroslav Breha. And he is a wonderful, wonderful musician, great person. And he's had a lot of experience of also running his own piano competition, aside from also being on the jury of the competition. So he would be a great person whose opinion I trust as well. And so those three are our jury members.
Well, three huge names in the piano world. Hats off to you. Now, you are sort of the new kids on the block as far as putting together a competition and festival. So how is that going for you?
I think we're both excited because, like Sean mentioned, we competed against each other. It's not about competing against each other, but it's just about competing. So we had to sit through all of those, you know, results ceremonies where people say whether you passed or you didn't. And now we have to be on the other side. We're the two people who are going to announce the results and tell people who made it to the next round, who hasn't, which is maybe the most unpleasant part of this, is, you know, there are going to be people who will not make it to the second or the final round of the competition. And aside from that, I think we are really having a great time, at least from my perspective. I mean, we had a very good time choosing the repertoire, and we wanted to attract as much of quality pianists by selecting a repertoire which is pretty challenging. And I think we did this.
Yeah, just the whole process has been fun, and it was a lot of fun to listen to all the DVD recordings and online submissions and choosing who's going to be competing. So that's been a fun process too.
You mentioned that you had put together quite a challenging rep list for both the junior and senior categories. Just give us a brief rundown on what folks have to perform when they're coming for this competition.
The junior division has DVD round plus the first round and second round, which is the final. And the seniors in this case have DVD round and then three live rounds when they come here. The last round of the senior category is completely free choice. But the rest of it, we asked for, you know, classical sonata complete for juniors, for example, Schubert impromptu.
Bach.
Yeah, there's Bach partita or a toccata in the senior category. We're asking for an etude. So those are just some of the highlights. But there are some pieces that, you know, all the really good pianists should have.
Well, I thought it was interesting in the senior category that you had for their last round, they got to pick, as you said, everything that they wanted to do. But the encore, then they had to select one of four or five pieces.
Yeah, it's just kind of a twist we wanted to have because we really want, I mean, as I said earlier, the competition is not just an event for the city, for the community, but it's also a great event for the competitors where they feel, you know, they are presenting what they can do. And in this case, we really want them to feel like it's their recital. And after that, they get to perform an encore. Yeah, I mean, we're choosing encores from five pieces, but they feel like, you know, they've performed this recital and here's their encore.
And that's definitely a great twist to competitions because there's no competition that has an encore selection. And it'll be interesting to see which encore piece they pick, depending on what their program is. It really does make it more of a concert feel versus just, you know, still competition. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun for the audience and we can't wait for it.
Now tell us, you are opening this up to the public and you were mentioning that a few of the concerts folks had to pay to get in, but a lot of them are going to be free. So tell us how this is all going to work on that first week in June.
Everything is free and open to the public except for the final rounds for both the juniors and seniors. The junior will cost $10 and for the seniors it's $25. So I think that's really great for people to come and attend anytime that they want, especially for the early rounds because they are all day long. And I think certainly there will be a lot more people who will come for the finals, but at least with the opening rounds being free, it's really inviting for people to come as they please. Tickets can be purchased at the Gallagher box office. I think they're already on sale now.
And the $25 for the final, it actually is not just a concert. In between each performance, there will also be some food served. So we will have some hors d'oeuvres and then even some hot food prepared. And there will also be two breaks, so between the first, second, and third. But also after the third person, before the announcement of the results and the results ceremony and the awards ceremony, there will also be quite a big break. So there will be some food. So you're paying not just to listen to music, but you also get some food with it.
Of course, Dimitri and Sean couldn't pull off a festival of this magnitude without attendance by audience members and a lot of help.
We just want to encourage people to attend. You know, a lot of these competitions aren't open to the public, and so we just want people to really have an experience, and it's going to be rewarding. I think people will be touched by what they hear. We've got some really great talent. I think our youngest competitor is 12?
Yes.
Yes, and he's really way mature beyond his years. I mean, you hear him play and you would never guess it's from a 12-year-old, so that's really exciting. And we do have competitors from all over the world. There's people coming from Russia, China. There's an Israeli pianist, but I think that person studies in the U.S.
Yeah.
Ukraine. And then, of course, people from this country. Someone's from Seattle, Cleveland, Boston. So I think we're well represented, and it's going to be just a wide range of different pianists.
I wanted to simply thank the community for the support that we've received for this competition. I want to thank especially Gloria Gibson and Dean Joel Hawk, who actually were on board from the very, very beginning of supporting this event. Without them, I think I'm not sure what we would have done. We were, I have to say, very pleasantly shocked how quickly we got the support and support from all the local people as well, from our board, from all the supporters who believed in this and supported this competition, because without it, this competition would not be happening. So I just wanted to make sure to say this.
The co-founders and artistic directors of the Midwest International Piano Competition, UNI's assistant professor of piano, Dr. Dmitry Vorobyev, and UNI's associate professor of piano, Sean Botkin. For more details on the Midwest International Piano Competition's opening and final round concerts, being held on June 1st through the 7th at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center, please go to their website at midwestpianocompetition.com. Also on June 1st, Red Cedar Chamber Music will be presenting the official world premiere of Iowa's own Michael Gilbertson's Three Rivers. That's at 7 p.m. at the CSPS Hall in Cedar Rapids. Also included on the concert will be Gilbertson's Circle the Wagons, plus a Hungarian trio by Kolosko. In May and June, the Watoto Children's Choir from Africa will be performing 11 concerts across the state. For more details about this ensemble and their tour schedule, please go to watoto.com. The Ames Town and Gown will host a May 11th performance of the Boreal Trio, featuring clarinet, viola, and piano, held at 7:30 at the Ames City Auditorium. And on May 17th, between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., three lecturers will speak about the late farmer, poet, and University of Northern Iowa professor James Hurst and his works at the Hurst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls. Don't go away. The Des Moines Metro Opera's artistic director, Michael Eagle, will talk about the DMMO's amazing summer festival opera offerings. Two caretakers of the Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home called Cedar Rock talk about their upcoming events. And Myrna Johnson, Iowa Public Radio's new executive director, steps into the spotlight. That's all ahead. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. It's the Iowa Art Showcase. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum.
I'm Karen Impala. Each week at this time, we feature concerts and recitals recorded
throughout
Iowa.
Bringing the cultural richness of our state to your radio. Iowa Public Radio Classical.
We have one of the most unusual seasons that we've ever programmed for 2014, and I say that with a bit of a mixture of pride and a mixture of trepidation all at the same time.
Michael Eagle, artistic director of the Des Moines Metro Opera, discussing this year's 42nd festival season. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. The Des Moines Metro Opera's festival, which runs from June 27th through July 20th at the Blank Performing Arts Center in Indianola, also includes a whole series of other opera-related events and new venues leading up to their main stage festival season.
We begin the season with Verdi's La Traviata, which is one of the greatest operas ever written, probably one of the most often produced around the United States and around the world. One of the middle operas by the great operatic giant Giuseppe Verdi, probably his most famous score, although there are many other fabulous scores that belong to Verdi as well, from his middle period. And it's an opera that has stood the test of time. This was one of the first operas ever written in the canon that was truly contemporary and meant to reflect the modern society in which Verdi lived and in which he found himself, based on first the novel by Alexandre Dumas-Fee called La Dame aux Camélias, The Lady of the Camellias, and then turned into a play shortly thereafter. And within 4 or 5 years of the debut of the novel, Verdi had already seen the play and become very well familiar with the story and set it to music. It deals with a subject that maybe to modern audiences doesn't seem quite as controversial, but at the time was a very, very difficult subject for people to come to grips with, and that was the story of a courtesan, what we might today call a prostitute, with a heart of gold and with the very best of intentions, doing the most that she could to reform her life, to find true love, but ultimately, of course, suffering from consumption that finally, in the end, takes her life. This is a heroine in a story that didn't fail to capture the hearts and minds of people in the 1850s when she first premiered on the stage and has held the boards in a variety of guises all the way through the years since. I mean, we think of the Greta Garbo film based on the book called Camille, and it even, in a certain guise, came back in the 80s as Pretty Woman with Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. So this is a story that is timeless. Our production will be a new one, which means that the scenery and all of the trappings on the stage are new, produced for the first time in conjunction with another opera company. We partnered with Virginia Opera to create and design this scenery, so we're very excited about this. And it's the first time it's been on our stage in 15 years, which is actually kind of a remarkable thing for an opera company to have gone that long without producing this great work.
Tell us who your principal characters are, and then who's conducting and who the stage directors are.
Sure. Our principal conductor, music director David Neely, will conduct this opera. Our stage director is a debut. Her name is Lillian Grogue, and she will be doing both our production and the Virginia Opera production. Our cast is headed by two debut artists. Caitlin Lynch is our Violetta, and a Mexican tenor named Diego Silva is our Alfredo. And then the third important role in the show, the pivotal role of Alfredo's father, Giorgio Germont, the patriarch of the story, will be sung by Todd Thomas, who is an audience favorite and a longtime member of our company. Our second opera of the season, the middle piece of the trio of titles, is our first 21st century opera. From the very beginnings of the organization, we've had a very strong and solid commitment to producing works from our own land and our own time and in the English language. I always wonder if people's assumption is that maybe opera composition stopped with Puccini. That is not the case. There are American operas, and there are many fabulous works that have been written over the course of the last 100 years. And I felt very strongly when I took this position a few years back that it couldn't be very much longer before we began to feature American works from the 21st century. And I knew that when we did that for the first time, I wanted to make sure that the work we chose was a work with a very strong track record and maybe even some familiarity with the title of the piece. And I knew that piece would be Jake Heggie's Dead Man Walking. This piece was first performed in 2000 as a commission by the San Francisco Opera, and has since gone on to be performed, I think, probably more than 60 times in new productions and revivals all around the world, as a matter of fact. There are many reasons, I think, that it's had such a strong track record since its inception, but not the least of which is that it's an amazing piece of theater, and so we programmed it for this season. Many of your listeners will know that this was a book by Sister Helen Prejean recounting her time spent as a spiritual advisor to an inmate on death row who happened to begin communications with her via letter. And then she finally takes the very big step of traveling to Angola Prison in southern Louisiana in the 1980s to meet this man to help him see if he can't get a pardon for his death sentence. And when that doesn't happen, then she works as his spiritual advisor to bring him to that final moment on death row. It was turned into a film in the 1990s starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. And as I say, the opera came about in 2000. It might at first hearing seem like an unusual subject matter for opera, but I think I can counter that by saying the best operas are those with very strong and very emotional stories, the stories that pack a wallop and have quite a punch to them. And this, I think, has that. I'm very excited to bring this to our audience and to bring it to our theater. And I look forward to a whole series of events that we have in the months leading up to the performance for audience members to become better acquainted with the story, to get more background on the tale, and to learn more about the ins and outs of capital punishment in America.
And you're partnering with Drake University, doing some amazing things and bringing some people in to help facilitate that.
That's right. We're calling it Staging Connections because we're trying to help folks connect to the subject matter and to this piece in an unusual way. To give a piece like this to our audiences that have the opportunity for us to partner in deeper ways with our community. We have to tell the stories of our own time on our stages, and we have to continue to demonstrate that art matters in our community and that art has something to say about the world in which we find ourselves. And this piece presents us with the opportunity to work with Drake University, with Grandview University, and with a series of other organizations to deepen our roots with the community through a mutually held topic of importance. Sister Helen herself will be here, and since this work began, she was very much involved in the writing and creation of it, and so she will be here on May 6th at 7 p.m. at Cheslow Auditorium to do a lecture and a book signing, and we anticipate that that will be a very popular event offered in conjunction with the President's Office at the Drake University Law School. We also have a death penalty panel discussion on June 4th at Drake University featuring actually the last trial lawyer who litigated the most recent death penalty case in the state of Iowa as one of the speakers that night. And we're very happy that the State Bar Association has approved that panel discussion on June 4th for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit for members of the Bar Association in Iowa. So that was a nice surprise for us and a real opportunity for us to work in the community. And then Jake Hege himself will be here. And Jake Hege, I think, is our preeminent living American opera composer, currently writing operas. Recently did Moby Dick for the Dallas Opera. And of course, Dead Man Walking is probably the opera written in the last 50 years that has galvanized the performing arts community in as much that it's garnered so many performances around the world.
Tell us who are going to be playing the principal roles and conducting and also directing.
Well, the performance will be conducted again by David Neely, our principal conductor and music director. Our stage director is Christine McIntyre. And then the two lead roles will be sung by Elise Qualiata, who is a mezzo who's appeared with us in a couple of smaller roles over the last couple of years, and she'll be singing the role of Sister Helen. And then Joseph de Rocher, the inmate, the central character, will be sung by David Adam Moore. And I cannot tell you how excited I am to have David Adam Moore making his debut with our company. Known as one of the strongest singing actors of his generation, and I know that audiences will enjoy his performance and be very, very moved by it.
Well, hats off to you for taking this work on and then providing all these extraneous things to go with it. Not only is the performance going to be powerful, but to have all of these extra events, that's...
Absolutely, and there's an outline of all of the events on our website, DesMoinesMetroOpera.org, under the Staging Connections series.
Tell us about the last piece of fluff that's going to take care of your season.
Well, I'm thrilled about Le Comte d'Ory. You know, we have trouble in opera with comedy in that they're so outnumbered by the tragedies. But we like to always include a comedy, and we're always on the search for comedies when it comes to programming to round out the season. I liken it to a musical glass of champagne. Often I've heard it referred to as French pastry by an Italian chef. And the reason that is that it was written by Gioachino Rossini, whom we know as the composer of The Barber of Seville and several other silly operas, and, of course, the Lone Ranger theme, which is the overture to his William Tell. He moved to Paris. He retired very early in his career, in his late 30s or early 40s, and remounted a couple of his works for Parisian theaters. And then the last two operas he wrote in his life were specifically written in the French language for Parisian audiences. And this piece in particular, Le Comte d'Ory, is certainly one of those. It is a silly opera based on the story of maybe a licentious nobleman named the Count Ory, set during the Crusades in the Middle Ages, although that's kind of an incidental. It can be set and done just about any time in any place. But while the rest of the men in the area have gone off to fight their Crusades, they've left the women of the castle undefended, and Le Comte d'Ory, the Count, has his eyes set on the Countess, Adele and thinks about any possible way that he can to infiltrate the castle and enjoy some private time with her, including the denouement of the opera is the Count Henri and his men hijack a group of nuns on pilgrimage to the Holy Land, secure their habits and their garments, pose as nuns seeking refuge for the night, and manage to work their way into the castle to seduce the ladies and to find the wine cellar, which they do quite quickly. And it's absolutely hilarious, frothy, melodic bubble of a piece that I think will be the perfect anecdote to Dead Man Walking. We have a fantastic cast. It's really a notorious piece in the opera industry for being very difficult to sing. The bel canto period in which this was composed is a time period in which the demands on the agility and the vocal requirements for each of the singers in all of those roles are extraordinary, and this piece is certainly chief among them, a tenor role that's fiendishly difficult. The title role is a very difficult role, and we have a fantastic tenor, Taylor Staton, who will be returning to us after an absence of a couple of years, having just been on stage at the Metropolitan Opera a few nights before. We record this today to sing the title role, and the Countess Adele will be sung by a young woman that I'm very excited to have debut with us. Her name is Sydney Mancasola, and she was one of the grand prize winners, one of the national finalists in the Metropolitan Opera's competition last year in 2013. She will be singing that role with us this season. So I'm secretly very excited about this opera. This is one that for me has been a long time coming, and I think our audiences will enjoy it, and listeners will appreciate the frivolity and the lightheartedness of the score.
Who's going to be directing and conducting this?
Our conductor is Dean Williamson. And he is a wonderful conductor whose work I've known and admired for quite some time, based out of the Seattle area, but is conducted all over the United States and abroad. And I went to him and asked him to conduct this piece because I know that he has a particular affinity for and specialty in bel canto operas, these Italian or Italianate operas of the 19th century, and had never attempted this piece before, but was very interested in trying it for the first time. And our director is David Gately, and David Gately is a name that, as I was talking to colleagues around the United States about who might be a good director for this production, his name came up every time. It's not produced very often, but David has done this piece a couple of other times and at other companies, and it was very well received each time he did it there, so I'm very excited to bring him here to do this new production of Le Comte Henri.
Michael discloses the Des Moines Metro Opera's new strategic initiative aimed at exploring new venues and expanding their opera offerings.
That is our second stages series production of The Tragedy of Carmen by Peter Brook, based on the Georges Bizet opera that we all know and love called Carmen. Peter Brook, very famous visionary British director, felt that it would be an interesting experiment to take the opera Carmen and to kind of remove a lot of the trappings of traditional operatic spectacle, remove the children, remove the animals and the parades, and focus more instead on the raw and the central, the emotional tale around really the stage world's most famous gypsy heroine. It's called The Tragedy of Carmen, and it is sung by four people and a chamber orchestra, and also includes four actors. We will be doing it on July 10th and July 19th at the Des Moines Social Club in their new Come and Go Theater, which has just recently opened up. It promises to be a very moving evening of theater. I think one of the aims of Peter Brook's when he began work on creating this Tragedy of Carmen, this 90-minute adaptation, was to maybe hearken back to a little bit more of the grittier nature of Prosper Mérimée's original novel that the opera was based on. As a matter of fact, one of the characters that was lost from the novel to Georges Bizet's opera is the character of Garcia, who is Carmen's husband. Little did we all know that Carmen was originally married. They don't tell you that in the traditional opera, but in the story, she was married to a man named Garcia, and he figures back into this opera as an actor, as a spoken role. And so the focus on this in The Tragedy of Carmen is a little bit more based on the novel and a little less on the big trappings of, you know, operatic spectacle. Most all of the opera's famous tunes and arias and all of the music we know and love is intact in this version, but maybe put together in a slightly different way.
And you're also going to be doing this peanut butter and puccini along with the Stars of Tomorrow.
Well, we have some of our customary events that we do every season. Our peanut butter and puccini program will be held on June 19th and 21st in the Blank Performing Arts Center. And that is a nice children's performance and then an opportunity for a backstage tour for children and families. There's the opportunity to try on costumes, to put on wigs, to see how the props work, to walk across the stage, to go up into the catwalks where the lights are hung, all of those sorts of things. And, of course, we have our Threads and Trills event on June 14th, which will be at the Wakanda Club, an annual costume show and luncheon sponsored by our guild chapters. And then I think one of my favorite events of the season, you mentioned, is will be held on July 16th, which is our Stars of Tomorrow concert at Cheslow Auditorium at Drake University. And that is an opportunity to hear the festival orchestra and members of our acclaimed apprentice artist program singing some of the most famous tunes, ensembles, duets, arias, quartets from the entire operatic repertory. Kind of a nice little sampler, a great introduction for people who maybe have never attended the opera to come to Drake on the night of July 16th and just get a nice little sampling of what the music sounds like, what great singing sounds like. This year it's a little special for us because this happens to be the 40th anniversary of our apprentice artist program. It's been 40 years that we've been working very hard at identifying those up-and-coming vocal talents from around the United States and bringing them to Central Iowa every summer to hone their craft, as it were.
The Des Moines Metro Opera's artistic director, Michael Eagle. Michael wants to let everyone know that their performance of Jake Hagee's Dead Man Walking does contain a parental advisory. This opera contains nudity, graphic violence, and explicit language, and is not recommended for anyone under age 18. To find out more about the Des Moines Metro Opera's upcoming festival season and other activities, please go to desmoinesmetroopera.org. Other opera offerings in May include the University of Iowa's production of Deflator Mouse. That's tonight at 8 and tomorrow afternoon at 2 at Iowa City's Engler Theater. Drake University Opera will present the Mikado tonight at the Harmon Fine Arts Center on the Drake campus in Des Moines. And Luther College Opera will present 2 one-act Puccini operas on May 9th and 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the Center for Faith and Life in Decorah. Just ahead, we take a road trip to one of Iowa's best-kept architectural secrets. And we get to meet Iowa Public Radio's new executive director, Myrna Johnson. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa broadcast.
Hi, I'm Kurt Snook on the choral tradition. Today,
welcome to University Concert. I'm Karen Impala.
Bringing the cultural richness of our state to your radio, Iowa Public Radio Classical.
Cedar Rock annually sees 10,000 or so touring visitors each season. Cedar Rock is unique because it's kind of like a classroom for students of Frank Lloyd Wright's work. We get a lot of visitors that specifically tour Frank Lloyd Wright sites, but we get a lot of people that just come because they see our large sign on Highway 20 and are interested in what this park is. And I think most of our visitors are equally excited with what they see here. A lot of our visitors talk about Cedar Rock being kind of a hidden jewel in rural Iowa, which is something that I think would really impress the homeowner, Lowell Walter, because it was one of his dreams to build something in rural Iowa that he thought would be comparable to the beautiful mansions and homes you could find in California and Florida or Colorado or something like that. So hearing people and their descriptions of Cedar Rock, it's really remarkable. We do get visitors from all 50 states. We average visitors from about 14 different foreign countries each year. There's a lot of interest in Frank Lloyd Wright. He was pretty involved in architecture also in Japan. So we get a lot of, you know, Asian visitors as well as German visitors with their Bauhaus style of architecture, and Australia as well, which is where Walter Burley Griffin ended up designing Hanna-Barbera. There's a lot of similar architectural styles that people really enjoy visiting Cedar Rock and seeing.
Not only do we think it's special, but Frank Lloyd Wright himself thought this was one of the special houses, because in 1956, he decided that he would recognize these homes and buildings. So he made approximately 24 red ceramic tiles with his initials on it, and he bestowed one of them to this house. So in 1956, Lowell and Agnes proudly displayed this tile where it's placed today at the entranceway to the house by the carport. And it is the only house or building in Iowa out of the 11 that Wright designed that possesses this signature tile. So it's very, very special. And every portion of the house is just touched by Wright, from the furniture to the china, the silverware, the pottery. Everything practically is specified by Wright, designed by Wright, or approved by Wright, right down to some of the housewarming gifts that came into the house even. So it's a very, very special house.
The Iowa Department of Natural Resources Program Planner 2, Catherine Hurd, and Vice President and Membership Chair of the Friends of Cedar Rock, James Daines. Catherine and James are just two of the dedicated caretakers of the Walter Estate, located outside of Quasqueton. Welcome back. This is the IWARD Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Agnes and Lowell Walters had the foresight to provide a trust fund to ensure the preservation of the Walter Estate and house. The Friends of Cedar Rock had been established earlier to assist with educational activities. With the financial downturn of 2008, the Cedar Rock Trust Fund could no longer support the maintenance of the property. The Friends of Cedar Rock acquired their not-for-profit status and now plan 3 fundraisers annually to assist with the upkeep of the estate.
Well, the house itself will open to the public May 21st. We'll start our regular tours, and they will run Wednesdays through Sundays. Our first tours will start at 10 o'clock in the morning and go every hour on the hour then to last tour leaving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But in addition to that, the Friends Group puts on several events throughout the year to help raise funds. The first one is going to be our annual, it's called the Strawberry Moon. And what we do is open the house and give people a chance to see it in its evening setting. We like to think of it as the grand lady puts on her finery for the evening here. And we will have at 7 o'clock that evening of June 14th, people can start coming to the visitor center and they'll be trolleyed down, and it just acts as kind of an open house. We have a lovely lady that comes in and plays the Steinway grand piano that's here in the house, plays it for them for entertainment. We serve refreshments under the carport area of the house. That council fire that normally they can view during the daytime comes to life at night because we build a fire there. Areas of the home that are not usually open on a regular tour, people can see the maid's quarters that normally they just get to peek into, and then the wonderful river pavilion that is not normally accessible through the inside is open, so you can see how the living quarters of the upper part of the river pavilion were. We call it Lowell's Man Cave. And or down below where the boat was stored, but also many of the areas on the outside of the home. And all of the clerestory windows have indirect lighting that shows up from the outside. And each one of the skylights in the garden room here has its own individual light bulb. So when you're outside coming up from the boathouse, it almost looks like a spaceship here with the lights shooting up. It's a wonderful opportunity to see Cedar Rock in a whole new perspective for people.
And then you have a boat event coming up as well.
When we decided to raise funds, we were looking at areas of the property that really needed probably the most attention, and one is this river pavilion, because Wright designed very few of these river pavilions for private homes, and ours is only one of two that are still left standing. So it had suffered a lot of deterioration over the years, being right on the river, taking the brunt of flooding and winter ice jams and things. So we started a fundraising campaign for that. So every year, in this year will be July 12th, we have a River Retreat Restoration Paddle. We allow people to come and either bring their own canoe or we have canoes and kayaks they can rent. And we'll start about 4 miles upstream here at the Iron Bridge access. And they'll paddle down and stop at the boat pavilion here at Cedar Rock and then continue on down and to the campgrounds in Quasqueton. It gives them an opportunity to see that boat pavilion at a whole different perspective from the riverside. When you look at it from the land, you just cannot enjoy the total perspective of how it has the cantilevers just like the house does and everything, and how it blends so well into the big rock that it's mounted to. Just a whole different way of looking at the boathouse from the river. So, well, Lowell has this beautiful boat pavilion, but he also built it for the reason that he owned a classic 1939 all-wood Thompson Brothers boat, which we still have on display at the visitor center. So we decided we would have an outboard motor and antique boat show. So we do have some people come with antique outboard motors and antique boats and display them up there at the visitor center so people can look at those on that day as well if they don't partake in the paddle, or those that go in the paddle come and see it after the paddle. So it's just a unique way to try to raise some funds for the restoration of the river pavilion.
And then in October you have another event as well.
Yes, every year towards the end of October. This year it's going to be the 18th, a Saturday, from 1 to 4, and it's called An Afternoon with Frank Lloyd Wright. It's kind of a symposium type event where we have two speakers come in and talk on Wright or Wright-related topics. So we try to cover any topic on either side of Wright's career as well as Mr. Wright.
So how can folks get more information and find out how to get here and all that kind of good stuff?
One of the best ways to find information and directions to Cedar Rock is through the Iowa Department of Natural Resources website. You can go to the individual parks, and Cedar Rock has a page through there. The Friends of Cedar Rock also has a newly designed website of their own, so at friendsofcedarrock.org, you can get information on where the park is, touring information. You can even make a donation to the Boathouse Campaign or become a member of the Friends of Cedar Rock if you're interested. The Friends of Cedar Rock also has a Facebook page. You can contact the site for any information as well. Park email is cedar_rock@dnr.iowa.gov. And you can call or contact the park at any time for information on the site. We also have a little lending library if anybody's interested on information on Frank Lloyd Wright. The visitor center at the park has displays on Frank Lloyd Wright, one on his kind of a pictorial timeline of his lifetime and some of his more well-known, I guess, structures that he created during his lifetime. There's also another timeline of the homeowners and information on the history of the house at the visitor center. There are models created by Iowa State architectural students at the Visitor Center as well. We also have a small gift shop there where if you're really interested in items from the house, we also have pieces of glass very similar to what we have in the home, t-shirts, postcards, that kind of thing as well.
The Iowa Department of Natural Resources Program Planner 2, Catherine Hurd, and Vice President and Membership Chair of the Friends of Cedar Rock, James Daines. Catherine and James, along with a host of other very devoted and enthusiastic custodians of the Walter Estate, are making the grounds ready for this year's crop of Wright and architecture enthusiasts. On Tuesday, May 6th, you'll find a very informative podcast of their entire interview on our website at iowapublicradio.org on the Iowa Art Showcase heading on the classical drop-down menu. The Frank Lloyd Wright Film Festival and Lecture Series continues on May 8th and 22nd at Mason City's Architectural Interpretive Center. For more details about the film festival and Stockman House tours, please see stockmanhouse.org. For details about Mason City's Historic Park Inn, please see historicparkinn.com. And the Walter Burley Griffin Society of America will also hold their 15th annual meeting in Mason City on May 30th and 31st. Just ahead, Iowa Public Radio welcomes Myrna Johnson back to the state. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Earlier this year, Myrna Johnson took over the reins as Iowa Public Radio's new executive director. In addition to meeting members at community open houses across the state, Myrna has been busy working to make Iowa Public Radio's excellent service even better. Myrna loves public radio and is glad to be back home.
I grew up in Ruthven, which is up near Spencer and in the Lakes region. I went to high school, Ruthven High School, graduated from there and went to Wartburg. And then my career has taken me to Baltimore, to Washington, to Colorado, to Boston, and now back here in Iowa.
And you got an advanced degree at Harvard.
I did. I did a master's program. It's a one-year mid-career program for people who are in the middle of their careers in public administration at the Harvard Kennedy School, which was great fun. It's one of those things I had had on my list for a very long time and feel really fortunate to have had the opportunity to do it.
Well, tell us a little bit about those wild and crazy Wartburg years.
They were very wild and crazy. But I was in the Wartburg College Band and really enjoyed that, actually. It was really, really very rewarding to have that to do there. And the one thing that was always really exciting about being in band at Wartburg was that we did a European tour. Every 4 years, the band went to Europe. And that was the highlight of my college career, really, to be able to do that. And we played concerts all over Europe, in Germany, in London, and saw the Wartburg Castle, which is very important to the history of Wartburg. Very, very good experience for a college student to get to go to Europe in that kind of a way.
Tell us about some of the career-type things that you've done.
I had the great opportunity to work at National Public Radio for 8 years. I worked in their government affairs office, and my job was to make sure that there were appropriations for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So it was all about public broadcasting funding. And it was just such a great environment to work in, and just such a gas to get on the elevator and see Bob Edwards and to hear the voices that I'd heard on the air and then turn around and actually see their face was just really, really fun. And I got such a huge appreciation for both the programming that's on public radio, but also the people that were behind it and the really rich system of stations that supported public radio. And I fell in love with it. So I'm just really excited to be back because it's kind of a first love for me to be back in public radio.
What are some of your favorite shows on public radio?
I'm a big fan of Weekend Edition Sunday. I think Rachel Martin's really, really smart. I think she's got a really great presence on the air, and I think that she does bring arts and culture into her show in a really wonderful way, and I really enjoy listening to it on Sunday morning.
And you worked with another public radio station, this time in Colorado.
I was on their board, actually, so I was working in Colorado and was on the community advisory board for the station KUNC in Greeley. It was licensed to the University of Northern Colorado. And while I was on the community advisory board, the university announced to the station staff one day that the Board of Regents was planning to sell the license the next day. And so the advisory board decided we couldn't let that stand. We went to the Board of Regents the next day and asked for them to give us time. We didn't quite know for what yet, but we just felt it wasn't fair, really, for them to sell the license on a dime like that, that the community really owned this station in many ways, and that they should have some say in what was going to happen to the station. And we ultimately came up with a plan to buy the station. And so the university gave us a month to come up with $2 million to buy the license, and we did, which it was just a fantastic experience, really showed me how public radio listeners care about their station and would just give to that level to keep their station. Very exciting time. And then I was on the board of directors in this new community licensed station, KUNC, no longer a part of the university, and helped design their first strategic plan. So that station I have a very, very soft spot in my heart for. And they're doing very well, which is very exciting.
So what were you doing right before you came here?
I was running an initiative in Boston to renovate schoolyards. We were putting in play spaces and outdoor classrooms on urban schoolyards in Boston. And it was great fun, really, really exciting work. We put in schoolyards on 84 schools, and we reached every elementary school in Boston.
Well, tell us, why did you want to come to Iowa and be a part of Iowa Public Radio?
It's really great to be back in Iowa. I'm really excited to be home, and I'm excited to be home in public radio. I'm a core listener. I'm a total public radio junkie and just really excited to be back working with public radio.
Well, tell us about how you feel about being in the state and what some of your interests are.
Well, one thing that I'm really enjoying is the wide open spaces again. You know, it's just such a new, again, thing for me, and just really beautiful. I just have these really fond memories of as I was a child, of riding my bike to the west end of town and watching the sunset. And when you live in a city or in a place where the mountains are to the west, you don't see the sunset. And so I've been taking so many sunset photos since being back. Just been so charmed by the little towns. I had kind of forgotten all of the wonderful little town squares with the courtyard at the end of it that are all over Iowa. And I've been driving through and stopping at a lot of those and taking in the town. So it feels really great. I'm reconnecting with a lot of old friends and kind of reacquainting myself with people that I've known for a very long time but hadn't seen in many, many years.
What about the arts in Iowa? How do you feel about that?
Well, I've been very impressed with what there is to offer here in Iowa, and I'm really excited about what Iowa Public Radio provides to its listeners in terms of recording and then sharing live music. I think it's fantastic. I'm just so impressed with the quantity and also the quality that's out there. And I think it's a really fantastic that we can, as a public radio service, bring Iowa culture to Iowans. And so those smaller towns that may not have their own symphony can hear a symphony that is an Iowa symphony. And I think that's an incredible service. And I'm very proud that we provide that. And when I was just looking at this position, I started listening to Iowa Public Radio. And I listened one weekend to an Iowa art showcase, and I got some great ideas for things that I would do in Iowa if I were there. And I thought, wow, this is a really great service. I mean, I think that weekend there was like a film festival in Mason City, and there were all kinds of plays and festivals. And I was just so impressed with the amount of things that were going on. And like I said, I could imagine myself going to them. So the Iowa Art Showcase introduced me to Iowa while I was back in Boston, and I think it's a great show, and I think it's a great service.
Iowa Public Radio's new executive director, Myrna Johnson. If you would like to reach Myrna, you can contact her via email at executivedirector@iowapublicradio.org or give her a call at 800-861-8000. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio Classical. Program thanks for this show goes to Dmitry Vorobiev, Sean Botkin, Michael Eagle, Catherine Hurd, James Danes, and Myrna Johnson. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Phil Moss and IPR's music director Al Scherz, along with IPR's Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was also provided by Nick Carlo and Scott Bosco. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.